Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today, we listen in to another segment of What It Takes, a podcast hosted by Alice Winkler. We also listen to an American story. This week, we hear A Retrieved Reformation by O. Henry. But first, we go to Brian Lynn.
The tropical storm Harvey in the United States and the monsoon in South Asia have again shown how dangerous and destructive floodwaters can be. More than 1,200 people have died across India, Bangladesh, and Nepal as a result of flooding. In the American state of Texas, more than 40 people have died and at least 30,000 have been displaced. These are the latest examples of powerful storms striking heavily populated areas, followed by extreme flooding. But storms alone are not the only cause of flooding. Increasing development has been blamed for taking away natural drainage areas that used to limit flooding in cities. The latest U.S. flooding following Hurricane Harvey was in Houston, Texas, America's fourth largest city. Areas around Houston have been hit with serious storm-caused flooding in the past, the last time in April 2016. At the time, scientists and experts blamed the flooding on continued growth across the city, according to the Texas Tribune. They called on officials to pass laws limiting developers from paving land that used to take in large amounts of rainwater. G.K. Bhatt is head of the think tank Taru Leading Edge. On the flooding in India, he said, in a normal ground outside the city, nearly 80% of the rain would have got absorbed. With concrete and tarmac all around, we are creating almost a near-total impervious area. Thus, the flood gets amplified in urban areas. Another big concern is rising sea levels that are predicted to put major areas of the world underwater in coming decades. Numerous scientific studies have confirmed that global sea levels began rising in the 19th century. The levels increased 14 to 17 centimeters during the 20th century and just keep rising. In July, hundreds of scientists from around the world gathered in New York City for a major conference to examine sea level rise. The conference was organized by the not-for-profit World Climate Research Program, with support from the United Nations, the U.S. Space Agency NASA, and other organizations. In its closing statement, the group said global sea levels are currently rising at a rate of about 30 centimeters per century. The group predicted that if climate conditions stay the same, world sea levels could rise 1 meter or more throughout the 21st century, possibly reaching several meters by 2300. A recent report by a group that analyzes climate changes in the Arctic said the area is currently warming faster than anywhere else on Earth. The Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Program said melting ice in the Arctic currently causes about 35% of global sea level rise. Over a period of decades, Experts say rising sea levels worldwide could cause disastrous flooding conditions. Numerous U.S. communities face this same threat. Many coastal areas already experience regular flooding problems, according to the Washington-based Union of Concerned Scientists. Erica Spanger Siegfried is a senior analyst with the organization's Climate and Energy Program. She oversaw two reports that identified areas across the U.S. experiencing what the group calls chronic inundation. It defines this as flooding that prevents people or businesses from carrying out normal daily activities.
What we see just in the next couple of decades is the expansion of areas that are chronically inundated to other currently unaffected parts of the coast. And really mid-century and beyond is when we start to see major metropolitan areas affected by this chronic inundation as well.
Spanger Siegfried suggested three main possible solutions to fight rising sea levels. The first is to build seawalls or levees. The second is to build homes elevated or create waterways to carry floodwaters. The third would be for people to relocate to areas not threatened by flooding. She says communities will likely use a combination of these methods in the short term.
It is human nature to reach for defensive measures and to try and simply keep the water out and keep maintain things as they are within communities, which is fully understandable.
Michael Bogan is a New York environmental lawyer. He told VOA that the U.S. government under President Barack Obama had taken steps to give local officials more power to regulate development as a way to prevent flooding. Bogan said one idea to deal with the problem is for governments to buy land from homeowners in areas with a high flood risk. Such a program was used in Staten Island, New York, after Hurricane Sandy caused widespread damage in the area. Owners of destroyed or damaged homes were made offers to sell the property to the state. Buyers of the property were then required to follow post-Sandy flood rules when building new homes. But Bogan says clearly that's not going to be a complete solution for cities with populations of 4, 6, or 8 million people, like New York or Houston. He added that in New York City, officials have explored the building of more environment-friendly infrastructure. The idea is to take areas that have been paved over and turn them back into natural land areas that can take in extra water during floods. I'm Brian Lynn.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Welcome to another episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement's recorded collection. I'm Alice Winkler. On every episode of What It Takes, we play you a revealing conversation with someone who has literally changed the world. And mind you, a lot of people say literally these days when they mean figuratively, but I mean literally, literally. The Academy of Achievement has been recording these conversations for decades. to document the extraordinary lives of people like Bill Gates, Alan Shepard, and Hank Aaron, but mostly to show that all of us can learn what it takes to do a little better, aim a little higher. There is arguably no one alive who has built a bigger empire of inspiration than Oprah Winfrey, or since America's on a first-name basis with her, Oprah.
Billy is grieving, and we, you know, feel compassion for him. And that's okay that he's grieving.
Yeah, I think it's important for his mom, Sherry, to know that it's okay for him to be sad. I mean, something tremendous has happened in his life, and he deserves that.
Gail Eichenthal sat down with Oprah for the Academy of Achievement in 1991. It was 5 years into her groundbreaking talk show and many years before the production company, the magazine, or the television network. Gail started by asking Oprah if she'd had any clue she'd one day make it so big.
As a young child, I had a vision not of what I wanted to accomplish, but I knew that my current circumstances, I was raised on a farm with my grandmother for the first 6 years of my life. I knew somehow that my life would be different and it would be better. I never had a clear cut vision of what it was I would be doing. I just always felt somehow. I remember absolutely physically feeling it at around 4 years old. I remember standing on the back porch. It was a screened-in porch, and my grandmother was boiling clothes because, you know, at that time we didn't have washing machines, and so people would, you know, physically boil clothes in a great big iron pot, and she was boiling clothes and poking them down. And I was watching her from the back porch, and I was 4 years old, and I remember thinking, my life won't be like this. My life won't be like this. It will be better. And it wasn't from a place of arrogance. It was just a place of knowing that things could be different for me somehow. I don't know what made me think that.
Did you ever consider any other career besides talking, broadcasting, acting?
I always wanted to be an actress. For most of my adolescent and adult life. My father didn't want me to be, because his idea of what an actress was one of these, you know, lewd women, and how are you going to take care of your life? So I always wanted to be an actress, and have taken, I think, a roundabout way to get there. Because I still don't feel fulfilled as an actress. I still feel like, okay, I own my own studio and all this, but I'm thinking, I did all of this just to be an actress. I just want to be able to act. For a while, I wanted to be a school teacher. In the fourth grade, Mrs. Duncan was my greatest inspiration. In the fourth grade is when I first began to believe in myself.
For the rest of that What It Takes interview with Oprah Winfrey, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Here's an American story.
A retrieved Reformation. In a prison shoe shop, Jimmy Valentine was busily at work making shoes. A prison officer came into the shop and led Jimmy to the prison office. There, Jimmy was given an important paper. It said that he was free. Jimmy took the paper without showing much pleasure or interest. He had been sent to prison to stay for 4 years. He had been there for 10 months. But he had expected to stay only 3 months. Jimmy Valentine had many friends outside the prison. A man with so many friends does not expect to stay in prison long.
"Valentine," said the chief prison officer, "you'll go out tomorrow morning. This is your chance. Make a man of yourself. You're not a bad fellow at heart. Stop breaking safes open and live a better life."
"Me?" said Jimmy in surprise. "I never broke into a safe in my life."
"Oh, no," the chief prison officer laughed. "Never. Let's see. How did you happen to get sent to prison for opening that safe in Springfield? Was it because you didn't want to tell where you really were? Perhaps you were with some lady and you didn't want to tell her name. Or was it because the judge didn't like you? You men always have a reason like that. You never go to prison because you broke open a safe.
Me? Jimmy said. His face still showed surprise. I was never in Springfield in my life.
Take him away, said the chief prison officer. Get him the clothes he needs for going outside. Bring him here again at 7 in the morning. And think about what I said, Valentine.
At 7:15 on the next morning, Jimmy stood again in the office. He had on some new clothes that did not fit him and a pair of new shoes that hurt his feet. These are the usual clothes given to a prisoner when he leaves the prison. Next, they gave him money to pay for his trip on a train to the city near the prison. They gave him $5 more. The $5 was supposed to help him become a better man. Then the chief prison officer put out his hand for a handshake. That was the end of Valentine, prisoner 9762. Mr. James Valentine walked out into the sunshine. He did not listen to the song of the birds or look at the green trees or smell the flowers. He went straight to a restaurant. There he tasted the first sweet joys of being free. He had a good dinner. After that, he went to the train station. He gave some money to a blind man who sat there asking for money, and then he got on the train. 3 hours later, he got off the train in a small town. Here, he went to the restaurant of Mike Dolan. Mike Dolan was alone there. After shaking hands, he said, I'm sorry we couldn't do it sooner, Jimmy, my boy. But there was that safe in Springfield, too. It wasn't easy. Feeling all right? Fine, said Jimmy. Is my room waiting for me? He went up and opened the door of a room at the back of the house. Everything was as he had left it. It was here they had found Jimmy when they took him to prison. There on the floor was a small piece of cloth. It had been torn from the coat of the cop as Jimmy was fighting to escape. There was a bed against the wall. Jimmy pulled the bed toward the middle of the room. The wall behind it looked like any wall. But now Jimmy found and opened a small door in it. From this opening, he pulled out a dust-covered bag. He opened this and looked lovingly at the tools for breaking open a safe. No finer tools could be found anyplace. They were complete. Everything needed was there. They had been made of a special material in the necessary sizes and shapes. Jimmy had planned them himself, and he was very proud of them. It had cost him over $900 to have these tools made at a place where they make such things for men who work at the job of safe breaking. In half an hour, Jimmy went downstairs and through the restaurant. He was now dressed in good clothes that fitted him well. He carried his dusted and cleaned bag. "Do you have everything planned?" asked Mike Dolan. "Me?" asked Jimmy, as if surprised. "I don't understand. I work for the New York famous bread and cake makers company. I sell the best bread and cake in the country." Mike enjoyed these words so much that Jimmy had to take a drink with him. Jimmy had some milk. He never drank anything stronger. A week after Valentine 9762 left the prison, a safe was broken open in Richmond, Indiana. No one knew who did it. $800 were taken. 2 weeks after that, a safe in Logansport was opened. It was a new kind of safe. It had been made, they said, so strong that no one could break it open. But someone did, and took $1,500. Then a safe in Jefferson City was opened. $5,000 were taken. This loss was a big one. Ben Price was a cop who worked on such important matters, and now he began to work on this. He went to Richmond, Indiana, and to Logansport to see how the safe breaking had been done in those places. He was heard to say, "I can see that Jim Valentine has been here. He's in business again. Look at the way he opened this one. Everything easy, everything clean. He's the only man who has the tools to do it. And he's the only man who knows how to use tools like this. Yes, I want Mr. Valentine. Next time he goes to prison, he's going to stay there until his time is finished." Ben Price knew how Jimmy worked. Jimmy would go from one city to another far away. He always worked alone. He always left quickly when he was finished. He enjoyed being with nice people. For all these reasons, it was not easy to catch Mr. Valentine.
People with safes full of money were glad to hear that Ben Price was at work trying to catch Mr. Valentine. One afternoon, Jimmy Valentine and his bag arrived in a small town named Elmore. Jimmy, looking as young as a college boy, walked down the street towards a hotel. A young lady walked across the street, passing him at the corner, and entered a door. Over the door was the sign, "The Elmore Bank." Jimmy Valentine looked into her eyes, forgetting at once what he was. He became another man. She looked away, and brighter color came into her face. Young men like Jimmy did not appear often in Elmore. Jimmy saw a boy near the bank door and began to ask questions about the town. After a time, the young lady came out and went on her way. She seemed not to see Jimmy as she passed him. "Isn't that young lady Polly Simpson?" asked Jimmy.
"No," said the boy. "She's Annabelle Adams. Her father owns this bank."
Jimmy went to the hotel, where he said his name was Ralph D. Spencer. He got a room there. He told the hotel man that he had come to Elmore to go into business. How was the shoe business? Was there already a good shoe shop? The man thought that Jimmy's clothes and manners were fine. He was happy to talk to him. Yes, Elmore needed a good shoe shop. There was no shop that sold just shoes. Shoes were sold in the big shops that sold everything. All business in Elmore was good. He hoped Mr. Spencer would decide to stay in Elmore. It was a pleasant town to live in, and the people were friendly. Mr. Spencer said that he would stay in town a few days and learn something about it. No, he said he himself would carry his bag up to the room. He didn't want a boy to take it. It was very heavy. Mr. Ralph Spencer remained in Elmore. He started a shoe shop. Business was good. Also, he made many friends, and he was successful with the wish of his heart. He met Annabelle Adams. He liked her better every day. At the end of a year, everyone in Elmore liked Mr. Ralph Spencer. His shoe shop was doing very good business, and he and Annabelle were going to be married in 2 weeks. Mr. Adams, the small-town banker, liked Spencer. Annabelle was very proud of him. He seemed already to belong to the Adams family. One day, Jimmy sat down in his room to write this letter, which he sent to one of his old friends. "Dear old friend, I want you to meet me at Sullivan's place next week on the evening of the 10th. I want to give you my tools. I know you'll be glad to have them. You couldn't buy them for $1,000. I finished with the old business a year ago. I have a nice shop, I'm living a better life, and I'm going to marry the best girl on earth 2 weeks from now. It's the only life. I would never again touch another man's money. After I marry, I'm going to go further west, where I'll never see anyone who knew me in my old life. I tell you, she's a wonderful girl. She trusts me. Your old friend, Jimmy." On the Monday night after Jimmy sent this letter, Ben Price arrived quietly in Elmore. He moved slowly about the town in his quiet way. He learned all that he wanted to know. Standing inside a shop, he watched Ralph D. Spencer walk by.
"You're going to marry the banker's daughter, are you, Jimmy?" said Ben to himself. "I don't feel sure about that."
The next morning, Jimmy was at the Adams home. He was going to a nearby city that day to buy new clothes for the wedding. He was also going to buy a gift for Annabelle. It would be his first trip out of Elmore. It was more than a year now since he had done any safe breaking. Most of the Adams family went to the bank together that morning. There were Mr. Adams, Annabelle, Jimmy and Annabelle's married sister with their two little girls, aged 5 and 9. They passed Jimmy's hotel, and Jimmy ran up to his room and brought along his bag. Then they went to the bank. All went inside, Jimmy too, for he was one of the family. Everyone in the bank was glad to see the good-looking, nice young man who was going to marry Annabelle. Jimmy put down his bag. Annabelle, laughing, put Jimmy's hat on her head and picked up the bag.
"How do I look?"
she asked.
Ralph, how heavy this bag is. It feels full of gold.
It's full of some things I don't need in my shop, Jimmy said. I'm taking them to the city, to the place where they came from. That saves me the cost of sending them. I'm going to be a married man. I must learn to save money. The Elmore Bank had a new safe. Mr. Adams was very proud of it, and he wanted everyone to see it. It was as large as a small room, and it had a very special door. The door was controlled by a clock. Using the clock, the banker planned the time when the door would open. At other times, no one, not even the banker himself, could open it. He explained about it to Mr. Spencer. Mr. Spencer seemed interested, but he did not seem to understand very easily. The two children, May and Agatha, enjoyed seeing the shining heavy door with all its special parts. While they were busy like this, Ben Price entered the bank and looked around. He told a young man who worked there that he had not come on business. He was waiting for a man. Suddenly, there was a cry from the women. They had not been watching the children. May, the 9-year-old, had playfully but firmly closed the door of the safe, and Agatha was inside. The old banker tried to open the door. He pulled at it for a moment. "The door can't be opened," he cried. "And the clock! I hadn't started it yet." Agatha's mother cried out again. "Quiet," said Mr. Adams, raising a shaking hand. "All be quiet for a moment. Agatha," he called as loudly as he could, "listen to me." They could hear, but not clearly, the sound of the child's voice. In the darkness inside the safe, she was wild with fear.
"My baby," her mother cried. "She will die of fear. Open the door. Break it open. Can't you men do something?"
"There isn't a man nearer than the city who could open that door," said Mr. Adams in a shaking voice. "My God, Spencer, what shall we do? That child, she can't live long in there. There isn't enough air, and the fear will kill her." Agatha's mother, wild too now, beat on the door with her hands. Annabelle turned to Jimmy, her large eyes full of pain, but with some hope, too. A woman thinks that the man she loves can somehow do anything.
"Can't you do something, Ralph? Try, won't you?"
He looked at her with a strange, soft smile on his lips and in his eyes. "Annabelle," he said, "give me that flower you're wearing, will you?" She could not believe that she had really heard him, but she put the flower in his hand. Jimmy took it and put it where he could not lose it. Then he pulled off his coat. With that act, Ralph D. Spencer passed away and Jimmy Valentine took his place.
"Stand away from the door, all of you," he commanded.
He put his bag on the table and opened it flat. From that time on, he seemed not to know that anyone else was near. Quickly, he laid the shining, strange tools on the table. The others watched as if they had lost the power to move. In a minute, Jimmy was at work on the door. In 10 minutes, faster than he had ever done it before, he had the door open. Agatha was taken into her mother's arms. Jimmy Valentine put on his coat and picked up the flower and walked toward the front door. As he went, he thought he heard a voice call,
"Ralph!"
He did not stop. At the door, a big man stood in his way.
"Hello, Ben,"
said Jimmy, still with his strange smile.
"You're here at last, are you? Let's go. I don't care now."
And then Ben Price acted rather strangely.
"I guess you were wrong about this, Mr. Spencer," he said. "I don't believe I know you, do I?"
And Ben Price turned and walked slowly down the street.
That's all the time we have today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.